This is Lecture 3 in the series Capital, the Productive Process, and the Rate of Profit.
Good morning once again. I'd like to begin by briefly recapitulating some of the high points of Tuesday's lecture. I hope it's clear to everyone why capital accumulation depends on the combination of the relative production of capital goods, which in turn depends on the demand for capital goods relative to the demand for consumer goods, and also the productivity of capital goods, the amount of output that can be obtained from any given quantity of capital goods. That's the analysis presented in, or illustrated in, figures 1 and 2. Now, it's probably helpful at this point to attach some additional cables between this discussion of economics and our fundamental philosophy. I indicated Tuesday, how the productivity of capital goods depends on economic freedom. That will keep up technological progress. It gives the maximum incentive to be efficient in general. And also, it's a very short step to realize that capital accumulation depends in every respect on the cultural influence of rationality. We're getting some feedback here, or at least either that or I'm having ringing in my ears. The extent to which there is a demand for capital goods relative to the demand for labor, that depends on saving and provision for the future. Now, this, of course, will depend on the security of property. If property is secure, people will be inclined to save, provide for the future, because they'll be in a position to benefit from it. That will result in a relatively high demand for capital goods relative to consumer goods. Also, if reason is influential through the culture, people will be operating on the conceptual level. They'll have the ability to make the future real to themselves in the present. They'll be almost certain to provide more heavily for the future than if they were not operating on the conceptual level. So the cultural influence of reason leads to the extent to which people will provide for the future relative to consuming in the present. It also underlies the security of property. It leads to settling disputes by negotiation rather than violence. It implies the rule of law, individual rights. Reason, of course, is deeper than freedom and rights. The influence of reason underlies science and technology and technological progress. It manifests itself down to the level of such things as how hard will a mechanic work who's supposed to fix your car? If he thinks answers are knowable and that he can find answers, then he'll work to find out what's wrong with it. The view of the potency of man underlies great entrepreneurship. In order for people to develop whole new industries, they have to have a conception of what is possible to human beings. So there are further aspects, but this should be an indication of how ultimately it's the values of reason and freedom that underlie capital accumulation. And I, in this connection, a very excellent tape I'd like to recommend to you is Dr. Peikoff's Philosophical Basis of Capitalism, which is the inspiration of these remarks. All right, now the last point of Tuesday's lecture was a demonstration of the fact that there is an inverse relationship between national income, nominal national income, in terms of straightforward dollars and cents, on the one side, and economic progress and prosperity on the other. We saw, just by comparing figures 1 and 2, that at the same time that in figure 2 we had capital accumulation and economic progress, we also had a lower national income than in figure 1. Now, it should be clear that that is the fact. I explained that national income is sales revenue throughout the whole economy minus costs on account of capital goods. Sales revenues minus costs merely on account of capital goods is equal to profits plus wages and interest. I hope no one has a problem with that. And if you see that, then it should be clear that when the demand for capital goods is greater, as in figure 2, costs on account of capital goods are going to end up being greater and national income will be less. And this is spelled out in tables 3 and table 2. Since this is preliminary to the main subject of today, let me briefly go over tables 3 and 2 on page 11 of the supplement. Let us imagine that we are living in conditions described by table 3, which is built on figure 2. Here we are. Every year we have a demand for capital goods of 600, a demand for consumers' goods of 400. Total sales revenues in every year are 1,000. And I have lines drawn from 600 down and 400 down and then over and up with an arrow showing sales revenue of 1,000. In every year, the 600 spending for capital goods, the 400 spending for consumer goods, represents 1,000 of total sales revenues. Now, the capital goods bought in each year are fully used up in producing the output of the next year. So I draw a slanting line with an arrow from the demand for capital goods of each year down to cost on account of capital goods for the next year. So now in year 2, we have 1,000 of sales revenues, reflecting 600 of spending to buy capital goods and 400 of spending for consumer goods. And now we have to deduct 600 of cost on account of capital goods, reflecting the previous year's spending of 600 to buy the capital goods that produce this output. And that's how we get to national income of only 400. Well, now imagine we're in this happy condition of table 3, figure 2. There's economic progress, production is increasing, prices are falling, our 400 national income buys more and more each year. And now imagine the government imposes taxes. And it imposes taxes of a kind that are paid with funds that otherwise would have been used to buy capital goods. So the government collects 100 in taxes paid with funds that up to now have been used to buy capital goods. And the government consumes these funds. All right, what then happens to the demand for capital goods and what happens to the demand for consumer goods? The demand for capital goods falls to 500. The demand for consumer goods rises to 500. Now we're up in the conditions of table 2. And what's going to happen to cost on account of capital goods, reflecting the fact that the previous year's demand for capital goods will soon be only 500? The cost on account of capital goods, the total cost on account of capital goods, will now drop from 600 to 500. So what happens to national income? It goes up. Now, national income is pre-tax. National income is incomes pre-tax. And what's happened here is we've substituted tax cost for capital goods costs. Taxes are not deducted in counting national income. The incomes are taken pre-tax. So national income has risen. It's risen by virtue of the fact we're deducting less of capital goods cost. Now, many of you have a difficulty in understanding how can it be that incomes and prosperity are inversely related. I think if you just focus on this example, you'll realize that they can be, that in this context they must be. But you also have other contexts, the context of your everyday experience, in which there is a close connection between your individual productivity and the money that you earn. any one of us who could suddenly improve his skills and double his physical productivity would very substantially increase his income, roughly in the same proportion. Well, I'm not going to attempt to reconcile that at this moment, because that's a fairly large subject, but I would like to get to it possibly later today if there's some question along those lines, or I'll certainly make an effort sometime in the next few days. But what I would ask you to try to do now is keep in mind that we are conducting an economic analysis in the context of what I've been calling an invariable money. We're assuming there's only so much money, and in that context, increases in production take the form not of people earning more money on an average, but they take the form of lower prices. We should think fundamentally that the way that improvements in production raise the standard of living is by virtue of lowering prices. That's the fundamental connection. Our standard of living goes up not by virtue of all of us making more money. The only thing that enables all of us to make more money, apart from the destruction of the economy, as in moving from figure two back to figure one, apart from such a terrible thing, the only thing that enables all of us to earn more money is the existence of a larger quantity of money. What actually raises our standard of living is the improvement in physical production. And the way that that works is by working to make prices lower. I mentioned at some point that real wages, real income in general, always depends on the relationship between the money you earn and the prices you have to pay. Improvements in the ability to produce improve that relationship, not by giving us more money, but by reducing the prices of the things we have to buy. That's the basic way that it works. And it's important to realize that and not to try always to translate things back into more money. Following Tuesday's lecture, someone asked, isn't it true that real national income goes up? Money national income falls from 500 to 400 when we go from figure 1 to 2. Now, you could say real national income goes up, but if you start thinking of it as, in some sense, the money is going up, your thinking is confused. You have to break the connection between money and wealth. You know, the old mercantilists supposedly viewed gold and silver as interchangeable with wealth. And they made the whole object of economic policy the heaping up of the biggest possible accumulation of gold and silver in a country's borders. And the classical economists came along and showed how mistaken they were. Wealth is not gold and silver. Gold and silver to some degree represent wealth to the extent you can have better electrical conductivity, whatever they're physically good for. But money as such is not wealth. Wealth is the ordinary physical goods, the steel, the shoes, the clothing, the housing. That is wealth. And the way that the greater production of wealth operates to raise the standard of living is by virtue of lowering prices. And even when prices aren't actually falling, the effect of the greater production of wealth coming in the midst of more money and spending, the greater production of wealth is still operating to prevent prices from rising. Okay, I hope to elaborate that aspect further later on. Let me turn now to what may appear to be a truly frightening diagram, figure 3. Now, at first glance, I would not be surprised if you just threw up your hands and said, what is this? Well, think back to the last time you bought a good like a VCR, and you opened the schematic or the picture of it with 24 different items and numbers, power button, eject, fast forward. I don't think this is really any more complex than that if we take the time to break it down into steps. Now, what we have here in large measure in figure 3 is a reproduction of figure 1 with added material. If you look back for just a second at figure 1 in year 2, we have 1K of capital goods in response to a demand for capital goods of 500. Over on the right, 1C of consumers' goods in response to a demand for consumers' goods of 500. And we have both of them resulting from production based on 1K of capital goods plus 1L of labor, devoted 50%, 50%. Now that exact same material appears in figure 3. If you look at year 2 in figure 3, well, we have 1K of capital goods and 1C of consumer goods. And we have them both emanating from 1K of capital goods back in year 1 plus 1L of labor, broken down 50-50. And we've got that element continuing. The only difference is, in figure 3, we are now giving a much greater prominence to money, and we're tracing the sources of the expenditures. All right, let me ask you to start with year 1. This is profits in a stationary economy with an invariable money. What we're out to do in figure 3, the object of figure 3, is to trace the process by which profits in the economic system are generated. We want to trace the process by which profits in the economy as a whole are generated. And in each year, we have three phases. We always start with the opening assets of business. Imagine it's January 1st. Business firms on January 1st possess a certain definite amount of assets. What are their assets? Well, physically, they have 1K of capital goods and they have 1C of consumer goods, just as before. Now, for the moment, ignore this information at a cost value of 400. I'll explain very shortly where that comes from. Don't let it bother you for the moment. Business firms have capital goods and they have consumer goods. What determines how we're classifying them is from the perspective of the customers who will buy these goods. The capital goods are those goods which the business firms have that are going to be sold to other businesses that will be paid for with the demand for capital goods. The consumer goods are the goods which will be sold to people who are buying them not for business purposes, who are buying them not for the sake of making subsequent sales. Business firms buy goods for the sake of making subsequent sales. Consumers buy goods not for the purpose of making subsequent sales. All right, we have these opening assets of business. They're capital goods, they're consumer goods, and we're introducing something new, cash. I'm assuming that business holds on January 1st 1,000 units of cash, which is waiting to be paid out for various purposes. And these gray boxes, all of the gray boxes, indicate the spending of money or the transfer of money. All the gray boxes indicate money or monetary transactions. The gray boxes are money or monetary transactions. All right, here we are. We've got these opening assets, capital goods, consumer goods, and in between, cash. Then the next phase of our analysis will be transactions. What's going to be done with the cash that business starts with? Now, I'm going to make a radically simplifying assumption that I briefly alluded to in my opening lecture. I'm going to assume that all transactions take place on the first day of the year. Business firms go out, They buy all their supplies for the coming year. They hire on all their workers for the coming year. The consumers with their incomes go and buy their supplies for a year. Why do that? Well, then we have it over and done with. We can only think of one thing at a time. We're going to compress all of the transactions for a year into a day. That will enable us to take care of the financial aspect of everything. Once that's done, the various parties retire to produce. They apply their labor to the capital goods that have been purchased. They produce what will emerge as the output of that's available, that's part of the assets of business at the start of the next year. We have production in any given year resulting in the opening assets of business on day one of the next year. And then we'll look at those assets on day one of the next year. There'll be a fresh round of transactions of the same nature as the transactions of the year before, and then there'll be production again. So we'll have a continuing set of things to look at in each year: opening assets, the various transactions, the process of production, resulting in a new set of opening assets to be followed by more transactions, more production. I think we're capturing the essence of things in a form that is as simple as I know how to make it. All right, well, let's start. In year one, we've got 1,000 units of cash to be paid out. 500 units of cash are paid out in the purchase of capital goods. And I draw a little arrow slanting down to the left from that cash box to the demand for capital goods, 500. 500 of the 1,000 of cash is taken and now represents, when it's spent, it's the demand for capital goods. And then I draw a little arrow pointing up. That 500 of spending for capital goods is buying the capital goods that business has. There are those individual businesses, let's say General Motors is spending some money to buy steel sheet from U.S. Steel. U.S. Steel is spending some money to buy iron ore from McKenna Mining. All the different business firms are spending something to buy capital goods. And those expenditures go into the possession of the other business firms that are selling the capital goods. So we've got an outlay of 500 units of money to buy capital goods. That money exchanges against the capital goods that were part of the opening assets of business. So that 500 of cash is coming back to business. Business began with 1,000 of cash, it spends 500 for capital goods, and those 500 come right back to business in the selling of the capital goods. Now we have some further outlays. I draw an arrow going down more or less under the center of that cash box. I'm showing wage payments of 300 units of money. And just next to the wages paid, I'm showing dividends of 200. Well, the payment of wages of 300 and dividends of 200 makes possible the demand for consumer goods of 500. This is where the consumers get their money. The consumers are the employees of business, or in effect, they're getting money in dividends or something comparable to dividends. Dividends should be taken as a stand-in for something somewhat wider, but the idea is conveyed in dividends. All right, the consumers now have 500, and that's the basis of the demand for consumer goods of 500. They spend the 500 in buying from business. They get the consumer goods. I have two arrows, the 500 being spent to buy the 1C of consumer goods and the 1C passing into the possession of the consumers. Now notice what's happened to the total cash holding of business. It stays at 1,000. All the 1,000 that business has laid out has come back. And we're assuming all this occurs in one day, or it could be one week, but in a very short, compressed period of time. All right, So business is going to be able to open year two once again in possession of 1,000 units of cash. All right, now we have to look at the production phase of things. Production in year one, just as before when we looked at figure one, production is going to take place on the basis of 1K of capital goods worked on by 1L of labor. The only thing we're introducing now is that this 1K of capital goods has been purchased for 500 units of money. And the 1L of labor has been purchased for 300 units of money. And I'm entering that data in the production box. I've got 1K of capital goods at 500 plus 1L of labor at 300 produce. See, now we have not only the physical elements in production, but we have the monetary values of those physical elements. So we have 800 worth of factors of production. All right, and now just as before, since in year two, the demand is going to be 500 for capital goods, 500 for consumer goods, and we're devoting half of the capital goods and labor of year one to producing capital goods for year two and the other half to producing consumer goods for year two, well, we're going to have a cost value brought forward. We've spent altogether 800 for 1K of capital goods and 1L of labor. 500 for the capital goods, 300 for the labor. And that's shown in these further looping lines. Notice from the opening assets of business, 1K of capital goods and demand for capital goods, 500, I have this further line coming down over on the far left in year one, and then cutting over at 90 degrees with an arrowhead. That shows where we're getting the capital goods and where the money value comes from. We paid 500 for 1K of capital goods, and that 1K of capital goods at 500 is what goes into the production box. And we paid 300 of wages, and I have a line coming out to the left from that gray wage dividend box, and then coming down and looping over with an arrowhead into production. We have 1L of labor at 300. That reflects the wages that we've paid. All right, now we devote the capital goods and labor 50-50 to the production of capital goods and consumers' goods. So what is going to be the cost value of the 1K of capital goods in year two? 400, 50% of the total of the 800. We have a total productive expenditure, a total expenditure for the means of production of 800, 500 plus 300. Half of that is 400. The cost value of the capital goods of year two is 400, so is the cost value of the consumer goods. Now we could break it down a little further. What's the cost value of the capital goods of year two insofar as it represents capital goods? 250, half of the 500. What's the cost value of the capital goods of year two insofar as it represents wage payments? 150, and similarly for consumer goods. Well, now notice here how we have derived cost values. The cost values reflect the previous outlays of money for the means of producing the items. The cost value of the consumer goods or the capital goods reflects the previous outlays of money to buy capital goods and labor and the allocation of those outlays in proportion to the respective revenues. I'm curious if anyone here knows anything about elementary accounting or bookkeeping. A few people. All right. Well, I think the way I've traced this out is perfectly in accordance with the principles of regular business accounting. There is an expression in accounting called cost of goods sold. Cost of goods sold. And the cost of goods sold reflect the value of goods held in inventory, which reflect before that the outlays for the means of producing the goods. We have outlays of 800 for means of production. That determines the value of the goods that we then open a period with, that we then open the year with. So our capital goods have a cost value of 400. Our consumer goods have a cost value of 400. And if you want to know how did we get the figures back in year one, well, this is year one for us, but we're jumping in the midst of a continuous process. Up in year one, the cost value of capital goods and the cost value of consumer goods derive from the outlays of year zero. It's the same process. All right, well now, we are in a position to actually see what the rate of profit is in this illustration. We have everything we need for the existence of a rate of profit. Profit is sales revenue minus costs. That's the amount of profit. Sales revenues minus costs. The rate of profit is the amount of profit divided by the amount of capital invested. The rate of profit is the amount of profit divided by the amount of capital invested. And we've actually got it all here. For example, in year two, what are sales revenues? 1,000, the sum of the 500 demand for capital goods plus the 500 demand for consumer goods. What are the costs to be deducted from the sales revenues of year two? 800. When the 1K of capital goods is sold in year two, it carries with it a cost value of 400. Something that cost 400 is being sold for 500. And likewise, the 1C of consumer goods. It cost 400, it's being sold for 500. So there is a profit of 200. We have sales revenues of 1,000 in total, costs of 800. Now, we can also infer the total capital invested. The total capital that's invested is equal to 1,800. It's equal to the value of the assets of the business firms. The business firms have assets of 1K of capital goods at 400, 1C of consumer goods at 400, and they're holding 1,000 of cash. So their total capital is 1,800. Now put that together with the total amount of profit being 200, and we have a precise rate of profit. It's equal to 11.11%. All right, can everyone see that we do have a determinate rate of profit here? Is there any problem in seeing how we arrive at a definite rate of profit, a definite average rate of profit? Just from business doing its business. Business buys capital goods, pays wages, pays dividends. These outlays are the source of sales revenues. Business is generating all of its own sales revenues through buying capital goods, through paying wages, the wage earners then expend their wages, through paying dividends, the dividend recipients expend their dividends. And costs emerge from the outlays for capital goods and labor. All right, so we can see profit is here. That it exists is beyond question. What we have to do now is analyze what it is in these various items that is actually generating the profit. All we really have to do is look at what is going on, look at it carefully, and we will derive the explanation of what is causing the profit. All right, we can get an insight if you turn to table 4. And also table 5 right below it. Now, there is a twofold connection between, there is a twofold involvement of productive expenditure in the generation of profit. Productive expenditure is the expenditure business makes for the purpose of making its sales. Productive expenditure is the demand for capital goods plus the demand for labor. Productive expenditure is the outlays businesses make, in this example, 800, for the purpose of bringing in their revenues. Productive expenditure has a twofold connection to profit. One is, in each year, productive expenditure is the source of most of business sales revenues. When business spends $500 to buy capital goods to produce its output for the following year, what does that $500 represent in terms of sales revenues this year? Isn't it $500 of sales revenues this year? When business pays $300 for labor to produce the output for the following year, what is the $300 that the wage earners then expend in buying consumer goods? What is the connection of that to sales revenues? There's $300. Well, the point is, the productive expenditure of any given year generates equivalent sales revenues in that same year. The productive expenditure of any given year generates equivalent sales revenues in that year. The demand for capital goods generates equivalent sales revenues by identity. What one set of businesses spend for capital goods, another set simultaneously receives as sales revenues. So productive expenditure for capital goods is simultaneously sales revenues. The productive expenditure for labor shows up as sales revenues when the wage earners consume their incomes. So productive expenditure generates sales revenues equal to the productive expenditure. All right, but what's the effect of productive expenditure on costs of the next year? What are the costs? If we have productive expenditure of 800 in year one, what are going to be the costs of year two? 800. Now in year two, there's another 800 of productive expenditure. Well, what do we have so far in terms of costs and sales revenues? Up to now, they're equal. Productive expenditure generates equivalent sales revenues, and in the next year, equivalent costs. Now, if we had the same productive expenditure going on repeated year in and year out, would we yet have a basis for profit? If we have equal costs and equal sales revenues, we don't yet have a basis for profit. So we know we have to look somewhere else besides productive expenditure. What we need is something that will explain how sales revenues can regularly and consistently exceed productive expenditure. Productive expenditure shows up equally in sales revenues and in costs. But profit means sales revenues exceed the costs. If we're going to have profit, we have to have sales revenues greater than productive expenditure. We need sources of sales revenues over and above productive expenditure. If we have sales revenues greater than productive expenditure, we've got the basis for profit. If sales revenues every year are greater than productive spending, then sales revenues are going to be greater than the costs to which the productive spending gives rise. So the crux of explaining how profit can exist in these conditions is we have to explain how sales revenues can exceed productive expenditure. Well, there is a way of doing this. There is a major continuing source of sales revenues over and above productive expenditure, and this is the consumption expenditure of businessmen and capitalists. Businessmen and capitalists don't only make productive expenditures. That represents most of the expenditures they make, but they also make consumption expenditures. They too have to live and enjoy life, and they make consumption expenditures. Now, I referred to dividends as a source of demand for consumer goods, and dividends are a source of demand for consumer goods. Well, let's just proceed for a few minutes on the assumption that we have dividends paid out of 200, and the dividend recipients consume the 200 of dividends. All right, when we add that to the 800 of sales revenues generated by productive spending, how much sales revenues do we now have? We have 1,000. Well, this consumption out of dividends represents a source of sales revenues over and above productive expenditure. And if we've got sales revenues above productive expenditure, we have the basis for sales revenues being above costs. We have profit. Now, I break this down step by step in Table 4, sources of sales revenues and sales revenues. And let's just analyze this. The major source of sales revenues is productive expenditure. One leading element of productive expenditure is demand for capital goods. And that generates identically equivalent receipts from the sale of capital goods. I have three lines showing identity. We have demand for labor. That generates equal receipts from the sale of consumer goods equal to the wages paid. And then we have this further item, consumption of businessmen and capitalists, parenthesis, net consumption. I'll explain the meaning of that phrase shortly. The consumption of businessmen and capitalists represents receipts from the sale of consumer goods to businessmen and capitalists. All right, we have here a source of sales revenues over and above productive expenditure. And then the productive expenditure of the previous year shows up as the cost deducted from the current year. What is it that enables the sales revenues of the current year to exceed those costs? Yes? The consumption of the businessmen and capitalists. That's the net consumption. Now, I illustrate this further in Table 5, which is entirely derived from Figure 3. I show in each of 4 years productive expenditure of 800. And I draw a line down from the 800, then over towards sales revenues and up with an arrow showing that there's 800 of sales revenues being generated. And then I have this item, net consumption, which you can take simply as the consumption of businessmen and capitalists coming from dividends and other such sources. And I draw a line over from it and then up, showing that this also contributes to sales revenues. We've got sales revenues of 1,000 in each year, generated 800 by productive spending and 200 by the personal consumption of the owners of business firms. In year two, we have identically the same thing repeated, but in year two, we have 800 of costs reflecting the productive expenditure of year one. And then we have the same situation repeated over and over in years three, four, five, on and on, without limit. Well, in each year, sales revenues are 1,000, costs are 800. Why are costs only 800? Because productive expenditure was only 800 the year before. What allows sales revenues to be 1,000 this year while productive expenditure is 800 again? The fact that there is consumption from the businessmen. Now let me point out, looking at dividends, when firms pay dividends, dividends do not represent any item of cost. When a firm pays a dividend, that is not like paying a wage or buying a material or a machine. There is no cost. The payment of dividends is not a cost deducted from sales revenues. Dividends are not the only transmission belt for the consumption of businessmen. Dividends apply to corporations. Corporations pay dividends. If you have a business which represents a sole proprietorship or a partnership, well, the proprietors or partners draw funds from their firms. They may decide, all right, we'll each take $1,000 a week out of the cash register and use that for our expenses, personal expenses. That's the draw of funds. That is not part of the cost of doing business. Whenever business firms, whenever the owners of businesses take their own money out of their businesses, that's not a cost. A cost arises only when there's a purchase. A purchase arises only when you have separate parties, one buying from the other. But owners of firms taking their own money, whether in dividends or in draw, that is not a purchase. Those are not items that would show up in any way as a cost. But the expenditure of the proceeds of the dividends show up in sales revenues and allow sales revenues to exceed productive expenditure. Now, this needs some further elaboration. When I say dividends, as I've just made clear, I mean more than dividends as the source of this consumption. I'm also including draw payments by partners and proprietors. You could have other sources, less common. Sometimes business firms that have outstanding securities might redeem some of their stocks or bonds. The sellers then have money coming from a business. They may turn around and buy stocks and bonds from others, but business has put out money into the hands of stock and bondholders, and they might consume out of that. That would be another source of such consumption, but that can't go on indefinitely. Now, what might come as a complication, if it bothers you, I'll suggest an easy way to solve the problem. When I talk about profits, I want to take them gross of interest. I want to treat profits that business firms earn and the interest that business firms pay together. And when I talk about profits, I want to talk about profits pre-deduction of this one particular cost, interest. Now let me indicate why I want to do that. I think Dr. Binswanger gave me the basis, hopefully, for making this clear. Profit, can this be seen? If we had a little light here. All right, we have profit over here and interest over here. Now, obviously, there are differences between them. They're not identical. But in contrast to wages, they belong together. And many of the leading issues in economics pertain to the capitalists, whether they earn profit or interest, together versus the wage earners. And to be able to deal, to analyze such issues, it is convenient to think of profit and interest together. And also, the rate of interest that actually exists is mainly determined by the rate of profit that can be earned apart from deducting the rate of interest. Whether or not businessmen can afford to borrow at 9% depends on what rate of profit they can make by investing the money they're borrowing. And that rate of profit does not yet deduct the rate of interest. It's gross of the rate of interest. If you want to know, is it worthwhile to borrow at 9%? Could you make 10% or 11%? Well, that 10% or 11% is prior to the deduction of the 9%, not after the deduction. So we'll want to view a profit as gross of interest cost. Now, we're ignoring interest as a cost, but interest is actually paid, and those who are paid interest consume out of their interest incomes. And the consumption of people who receive interest generates business sales revenue, and it helps to make business sales revenue exceed the costs that we're looking at. The fact that people consume out of their interest generates business sales revenues. We're not looking at interest as a cost for the reasons I've explained, but the consumption out of the interest that's paid helps to make sales revenues greater than all the costs other than interest. Consumption out of the interest that's paid contributes to making sales revenues greater than costs on account of capital goods and greater than costs on account of wages. So consumption out of interest has to be regarded as another source of consumption. All right, when we look at dividends, draw payments, interest, whatever, the critical thing that allows the sales revenues to exceed productive expenditure is the consumption that is taking place. When I say here that we have dividends of 200, making it possible for profits to continue to be 200, what we're really looking at is insofar as dividends are consumed. Now, what would happen to the extent that dividends are not consumed? What would happen to the extent people get dividends, but they turn them back to business firms, which then productively expend them? There'd be a greater demand for capital goods, a greater demand for labor. Productive expenditure would be greater. Can dividends, to the extent that they're saved and productively expended, can they account for sales being greater than productive expenditure? To the extent that the dividends are saved and productively expended, they would not explain sales being greater than productive expenditure. So what we're really talking about when I say dividends, draw payments, I'm talking insofar as dividends, draw payments, etc., are consumed. It is the consumption of the owners and creditors of business. It's their consumption that is a source of sales revenues over and above productive expenditure. It's the consumption of businessmen and capitalists that is the source of sales revenues over and above productive expenditure. Now, I give the name net consumption, net consumption, to what I'm talking about. And if you turn to the bottom of page 12, the last item, we want to see precisely where the excess of sales revenues over productive expenditure lies. And in line B, I'm telling you sales revenues equal the demand for capital goods, D sub K, plus the demand for consumer goods, D sub C. That's sales revenues. And that's what we looked at and have been talking about all along. I just didn't use these symbols before. And what is productive expenditure equal? The demand for capital goods plus the demand for labor. Now, if we want to see where is the source of sales revenues being greater than productive expenditure, all we need to do is subtract the one from the other. If we have demand for capital goods plus the demand for consumer goods, that's sales revenues, minus the demand for capital goods and the demand for labor, which is productive expenditure, well, what will that equal? It equals the demand for consumer goods minus the demand for labor. It's equal to the excess of consumption over wages. Sales revenues exceed productive expenditure to the extent that consumption expenditure exceeds wage payments. Now, why is that? Well, one huge chunk of sales revenues is the demand for capital goods, but that's also one huge chunk of productive expenditure. That's a wash. To whatever extent sales revenues in the economy exceed productive expenditure, it's got to be the demand for consumer goods exceeding the demand for labor. And I call this net consumption. And all I mean by it is consumption minus wages. To whatever extent consumption exceeds wages, that's net consumption. That is the source of sales revenues in the economy exceeding productive spending. And since productive spending is what generates costs, net consumption is the source of profit. Let me qualify that. If we had an economy with a fixed quantity of money and a fixed volume of spending, if we have an economy with an invariable money, net consumption is the permanent abiding source of profit in the economic system. In the context of an economy with no increase in money and spending, year after year maintaining the same total spending, what allows sales revenues to exceed productive spending and thus to exceed costs is net consumption. Now notice, to relate this to previous discussion, when you buy a product, what makes that issue so important, what it is you're buying, that when you buy a product, you're only buying the product you pay for, you are not buying the means of production. If profit exists, what is the normal relationship between the money that is spent to buy products and the money that is spent to produce those products? Isn't it the case that the money that is spent to buy products regularly and consistently exceeds the money that is spent to produce products? That's the basis of profit. Well, what is it that makes that possible? It's the fact that there is consumption spending over and above wages. When you consume, you're not paying wages, you're not buying the capital goods, all you're doing is consuming. Wages are paid in the payment of wages. The fact that the wages are consumed generates sales revenues equal to the wages, but then there's consumption over and above wage payments, and that generates sales revenues above wages. It generates total sales revenues above productive expenditure. So net consumption is the permanent abiding source of profit in an economy with an invariable money. Now, I have no idea where this hour went. I was just about to launch on a fresh point, but I think probably this is enough. There are assumptions I've made which I had wanted to spend some time justifying. We'll see to what extent you may think they need justification. I'll try, if possible, to work them in the question period. So let's open the floor to questions. Yes. Mr. Kalix.
You mentioned that the profit comes from consumption exceeding the cost of the production. Now, how can
No,
you
from consumption exceeding wage payments.
Wages, excuse me. Where does that additional money, I don't know if I'm using the right term, but where does the additional money for that consumption come from if the wages are more than the wages that those people receive? I'm having a problem with that.
Where does the money come from for the additional consumption if the wages are more than the people receive?
No. If the consumption exceeds the wages that are paid out, where does that additional net consumption that you bring up come from, besides just dividends and interest? Or is it just dividends and interest in your account?
Where does the money come from that makes it possible for consumption to exceed wage payments? In the context of an economy with an invariable money, the answer is precisely dividends, draw, and interest payments. Now, you might ask the question, mustn't you first have profits to pay dividends, draw, and interest? Well, let's even grant that that you do. All right, the question is, what keeps the profits in existence? Or let's put it this way. Suppose we started out in a condition in which there is no profit. Let's imagine in Figure 3 we revised it so that everything was the same except that in year 1 somehow costs were 1,000. Productive spending is 800, costs are 1,000. There is zero profit. Could costs remain at 1,000 if productive spending is only 800? They couldn't. Or let's try to view it this way. Suppose we're in the midst of a depression. And in the midst of the depression, practically all businesses are losing money. Hardly anybody is making any money. All right, does that mean that in the Depression, no business firms are paying any dividends, whoever owns a business is simply dying of starvation? What are they doing? All right, they're living off accumulated capital. More corporations than not, I believe, continue to pay dividends. Partnerships and proprietors, the owners continue to draw funds. The corporations had to continue to pay interest. The recipients continue to consume. People who owned stocks that weren't paying any dividends sold the stocks and consumed part of the proceeds. All right, even in the depths of a depression, there is net consumption. Now, if we have net consumption, if sales revenues are exceeding costs, I'm sorry, if sales revenues are exceeding productive expenditure, the implication is that as soon as costs reflect the lower level of productive expenditure, what's going to happen? Profit must come back. So long as there is net consumption, profit will spring back into existence. If we have sales revenues greater than productive spending, the only way profit cannot exist is if somehow costs are greater than productive spending. But costs cannot permanently be greater than productive spending. Net consumption works as a virtual spring to profitability. If there's net consumption, profit will have to follow because sales revenues are greater than productive expenditure. And what's the basis of the net consumption? Well, if any capital has been accumulated in the past, the very fact that capital has been accumulated is going to be a foundation of the consumption of its owners. And there will be a rate of profit established such that it will at least equal their consumption. This gentleman here.
If wage earners save some of their earnings, then one of the equations you have, one of the identities you have, wouldn't hold exactly because the demand for labor would exceed the receipts from the sale of consumables to wage earners. And I wonder if that occurred, would you redefine net consumption to be consumption of businessmen and capitalists minus savings of wage earners?
All right, this is an excellent question. The question is, what happens to the extent that wage earners save? How does this affect net consumption? Does it call for a redefinition? And this was one of the questions that I wanted to get into. All right. To the extent that wage earners save and their savings would come back and add to productive expenditure. Imagine we have wage earners, they're being paid and they use part of their wages and kick it back to the company in an employee stock purchase program, and the companies use it to make additional productive expenditure. To that extent, net consumption would be reduced. See, net consumption is consumption minus wages. If the wage earners don't consume as much as their wages, then to that extent, the excess of consumption over wages is diminished. Now, in figure 3, I made the assumption that all wages were consumed. And that was done partly for purposes of simplification, since this is a further discussion. But also, I think that that assumption is pretty close to the mark in reality, even allowing for the fact that most wage earners do some saving. Let's consider the kind of saving that most wage earners do. Where does their money go? It goes into savings and loan associations, savings banks, life insurance companies. This is to a very considerable extent. And what do such outfits acquire as their main asset? They make loans for people to buy homes on mortgage, installment credit. Now, to this extent, what sort of things are being financed? Consumer goods. So now you can have wage earners saving, but to a very, very considerable extent, their savings are used to finance the purchase of consumer goods. Now, to some degree, wage earners are saving to start their own businesses. They're buying securities and so forth. But then there are also business firms which are financing home mortgages and installment credit and so on. So I don't think we go that far off the mark if we assume that wages show up as consumption. It might not be fully accurate, but it's not very far off. But your question is an excellent one. To whatever extent there is saving by wage earners over and above financing of consumer loans, and that more than offsets business financing of consumer loans, to that extent, net consumption is reduced. Yes, Mr. Kaplan.
Yes, I'd like to go back to what you said about profit and interest.
Yeah.
Now, would you agree with the neoclassical theory that interest is determined by time preference and the marginal productivity of capital, or would you agree with von Bawerk's theory that it's determined monistically by time preference?
All right. Would I agree with the neoclassical idea that the rate of interest is determined by the marginal productivity of capital and time preference, or you said von Bawerk's idea that it's determined exclusively by time preference. You really mean von Mises' idea that it's exclusively determined by time preference. Von Bawerk would be more on the other axis. All right. I would say that the rate of profit and interest is determined primarily by the what I'll call the rate of net consumption. Simply the ratio of the amount of net consumption to the amount of capital accumulated. In figure 3, the amount of net consumption is 200. The amount of accumulated capital is 1,800. The rate of net consumption is 11.11%, and that's the rate of profit. Now, what about time preference? What about the productivity of capital? The productivity of capital, I don't think, has any direct bearing on the rate of return at all. The productivity of capital is vital to explaining what determines capital accumulation. The prevailing theory in the textbooks is that capital accumulation is determined exclusively by saving. And the effect of more saving is presented as reducing the rate of profit. And what's supposed to hold up the rate of profit is technological progress that raises the productivity of capital, that keeps the productivity of capital up. In my view, technological progress and the productivity of capital operate on the supply of capital goods. Technological progress is important not as determining the demand for capital in any sense, but as determining the supply of capital goods. Time preference enters as a determinant of the rate of net consumption. I don't think there's any direct way that time preference operates on the rate of profit except by influencing the rate of net consumption. Now, how could time preference operate on the rate of net consumption? All right, suppose we have someone, he has some definite amount of accumulated capital. Let's say he's got $1 million. All right, how does an individual view $1 million? What's he going to do with it? Well, he'll want his $1 million to provide for some period of the future. Suppose we have an individual whose real period of the future, who is consciously aware of and concerned with a future period of 40 years. That is his time horizon, 40 years. And he's got $1 million. How will he regard how much of his million is available for being consumed in any given year? 25,000, 2.5%. All right, if such an individual, if such an attitude were the average one throughout the economy, what would be the rate of net consumption? 2.5%. Suppose the time horizon shortens, and instead of it being 40 years, it's 10 years. Then the net consumption rate would be 10%. Well, the shorter the time horizon, the higher the net consumption rate, looking at it this way. And if your time horizon was till 5 o'clock this afternoon, then you'd have a net consumption rate approaching infinity. So the more future-oriented a culture, the higher the conceptual level of activity, the more the future has present reality, the longer will be the time horizon, and the lower will be the rate of net consumption. And I think this is how time preference plays a role. But apart from being able to connect time preference to net consumption, I don't think the theory is valid. I think the time preference theory is valid only to the extent that it can be connected to net consumption. And the productivity theory, I've indicated my view. This gentleman right here.
Do you see beneficial or harmful consequences to a culture with a longer or shorter time preference?
Well, I think the implications should be clear if you think about it. What is the effect if we have a longer time horizon, more concerned with the future, what will be the effect on the relative production of capital goods. We'd be concentrating more heavily on the production of capital goods. What would be the effect on economic progress? It would increase. Well, a major part of the explanation of how we came to the modern economic world out of the Dark Ages, what do you think happened to people's time horizons between 900 and 1900? They radically lengthened, and the growing cultural influence of reason would be fundamentally responsible for that. It would put people more on a conceptual level, and then it indirectly contributes to things settling down. You don't have to worry about being robbed by the Vikings or the neighboring lord or your lord. So people became much more future-oriented through a growing security of property and a greater future orientation, operating on the conceptual level. That would work to radically reduce the rate of net consumption, and as far as the rate of profit depends on the rate of net consumption, to reduce the rate of profit and interest. And at the same time, lead to a much greater concentration on the production of capital goods, and that's a major foundation for economic progress. Yes, in the back, Mr. Hurwitz.
Marjorie Smith, could you tell me how savings in the economy gets to the investment of capital goods? Because you just told us how if we put our money in a savings and loan, and they'll lend it out to other people to buy homes, et cetera. But if I go buy 10,000 shares of IBM, IBM doesn't get that money. The stockbroker takes his percentage and sells it to somebody who wants to, gives the money to somebody who wanted to sell their shares.
Right. Okay. How do savings get to the investment of capital in business? And then you're raising a special problem. What about when you buy already outstanding shares? Now, to a large degree, there are new issues, and if IBM were floating a new issue and you subscribe to it, then there's no problem of how your money gets to IBM. All right, let's say, though, you're buying already outstanding shares. We have to look at who's selling the outstanding shares. Very often, let's say we have someone who owns a small business. Let's say he has a drugstore, and he has 100 shares of IBM. He wants to enlarge his drugstore. And now he sells his shares of IBM, which you buy, and then he uses the proceeds to expand his drugstore. That's how money can get used also. Or someone sells his IBM, and he puts the money in a bank account, a time deposit, and the bank then lends it to some business firm. The saving is channeled back in one form or another. Now, there might be instances in which the current saving is not channeled back, but still, the whole thrust of the thing is that the securities markets promote the actual investment. Imagine someone couldn't sell his shares until they were redeemed by the company. What would that do to the purchase of them in the first place? You wouldn't buy them. Basically, the funds which are saved are channeled back. The gentleman over here. I'm sorry?
When determining the rate of profits for a corporation, I can understand that you take the profit and divide it by the total assets of the business, which would include the money held by the business.
Yeah.
I don't understand why for the total economy we would include the money held by all businesses as part of the business assets.
Are you saying you would understand why for a corporation you'd count the money that it holds as part of its capital? We would do that for any business. I think perhaps the question you have in mind is, am I saying that we would count as part of the capital the money that you or I have, the total money in the economy? Is that what you mean, money held outside business firms?
When I look at a corporation, it seems like the money that a corporation has is an asset.
Yeah.
In the sense that it can go and buy make productive expenditures with that money from other corporations.
Yeah.
But when we put all the corporations together, I don't understand why you would include the total amount of money held by all corporations as an asset in a macroeconomic sense.
All right, well, you see, why would we, when we look at all the corporations together, would we continue to hold, to view the money as an asset when all the corporations together couldn't use the money, right? Well, we're still keeping the perspective of the individuals, and we're looking at what is determining the average profit that real-life business firms make, and they're calculating it on the basis of the money they hold. And so if we want to know what is the average rate of profit that will actually prevail, we have to allow for the money that is held. The fact that if the economic system somehow came to be operated as a collectivist unit, there'd be no place to spend the money, that's not actually relevant. Now also, it's not correct in reality that all of the money is in the hands of business firms. And we would not count as part of the capital the money that's outside of business firms. It's the money held by business firms that would be one of their assets. A couple of points on this. Figure 3 and what will follow radically overstate the role of money. I've given money in an enormous magnitude. I've assumed that the money is spent only once in the whole year. That was strictly for purposes of illustration. In reality, a given quantity of money is spent many times through the year, so money would be much smaller relative to the other assets. Another point, I assumed that all of the money was in the hands of business firms because all of the money in the economy is constantly gravitating toward business firms. I think we could advance a proposition, money comes to goods. Money comes to goods. It isn't the case that it's the consumers out there who are holding the money and who have business by the throat and business is constantly dependent on getting the money back from the consumers. If we look at any one individual business or any one industry, we could say there's a radical dependency of the individual business on the consumers. Microeconomically, business is dependent on the consumers, any individual business. But why? Competition. The consumers can spend their money somewhere else. But macroeconomically, the dependence is the other way. The consumers, in the aggregate, are totally dependent on business. What are they going to do with their money except buy something from business? Of what good is the money? Anything you want to keep you alive or have enjoyment or pleasure, you'll have to, as far as it depends on money, you'll have to spend the money buying something. This is what I mean by all the money tending to gravitate toward business. And that's why I assume business opens with all the money and the money comes back to business. It's just not the case that the consumers are deciding whether or not they'll be gracious enough to consume and can therefore destroy the economy. Sooner or later, they consume. Yes?
Can you contrast interest and dividend a little more? I understand how they're both a type of payback and yet not part of a legitimate day-to-day business running expense. Dividends with wages.
All right, you're asking, could I contrast dividends and interest a little more? You say you understand that they're not an everyday business expense. They're not like wages, but I've linked dividends and wages. All right, I've linked dividends and wages only in the sense that both are sources of consumer spending. And so is interest. Dividends was a shorthand. I couldn't fit more on a line on that page, unless I set everything in a smaller scale. The funds that businesses pay out as dividends and interest and the draw payments to proprietors and partners, they're sources of consumption just as wages. And they make it possible for sales revenue to exceed productive spending. Dividends and interest are unlike in that if we're strict about it, interest is a cost of business. Dividends are never a cost of business. See, the dividends are received by the owners of business taking their own money. The recipients of interest are not the actual owners, they're creditors. We are just treating interest and profit together because the rate of profit pre-interest determines the rate of interest, and also in contrast to wages, it belongs with dividend, with profit. Now, someone had sent a written question, which I'd like to try to answer, and then I'm afraid I'll have to close for the time being. Could you clarify your explanation? This pertains to the excerpt from my book that was distributed. Could you clarify your explanation of why the contribution to gross national product of a retailer is the difference between the sales revenue and the wholesale price? Why is this not treated as it is at other stages of production? I don't understand why it is significant that the product is merely an alteration in or with respect to an already existing entity. It seems to me that when I buy bread at the store, I am buying bread at the store, not bread at the factory plus transportation plus the clerk's wages, etc. I would think that the crucial distinction is that the spending represents another layer in the division of labor, not whether there is a significant change in the physical product. If the latter distinction is important, then shouldn't internal spending be counted within a vertically integrated company? Also, how would you handle production spending within the service sector where there may not be any physical product? All right, the main thing is I would count all spending. And if we ask what is the spending, it's the spending for the bread at retail. But if you ask me, does the retailer produce the bread? No, the baker produces the bread. The retailer makes the bread more accessible. If you bring your pants in to be pressed, is the product of the tailor pressed pants using up pants? Or if he puts cuffs on them? I think in terms of physical production, the issue of whether or not there's a change in entity is decisive. In terms of spending, all of the spending should be counted. I don't think gross national product is something that we can measure in terms of money. I think it's a mistake to think of it that way. This issue of if something is internally produced, don't we need to measure it? Gross national product does not measure production. Money does not measure production. Money exchanges for goods. The only thing that allows more money in total to exchange is if there's more money. And money, a bigger monetary gross national product, doesn't measure more goods. What it really measures is, or reflects, is that there's a larger quantity of money. So it's not a measure. All right, well, I don't think I can hold you any further. So it's time we take a break. Thank you very much.